Tomorrow, I am going down to Green Hall. Rebecca and I are going to see Rodney Crowell.
Oh, very cool.
I didn't know how we were going to be able to swing it because, you know, of like real life and stuff. And it's a Thursday evening show, but we're going to do it, man.
Good.
We're taking the tour bus so we can, we're going to drive down tomorrow.
Like the real one, like Nino's coming up.
Yeah, dude, you hadn't seen Zeus, have you?
Oh, no. Did it get redone?
Oh, man. Just the outside. Like the regular black paint, the glossy black, has never seen the light of day. They made that bus and then flat black wrapped it. Dude, it's fucking sharp looking.
Oh, so they took the black wrap off.
It's
like taking the plastic off your guitar and it's perfect.
Yes, exactly.
Ah. Man, Nino's so happy.
He is.
Oh, yeah. He didn't like that.
He hated that fucking matte black. He always bitched about how hard it was. Keep that thing clean.
Yep.
We're going down. We're driving down tomorrow. He's picking us up at noon. We get to meet Rodney, which is super cool.
Nice.
Yeah.
Can you have him say double date Debbie with the pole in my pants or record it?
I'll ask him.
I'm just kidding, man.
What's up?
Hey, man, how are you? I was just telling the guys, Rodney Crowell's at Green Hall tomorrow, and my wife and I are going to drive down there and check that out.
Nice.
Yeah, man, I'm super stoked. I'm being very nerd-like, though. I went and my favorite Rodney Crowell record is Fate's Right Hand. It came out in like 2003. It's my favorite record of all time by any artist.
That's something to say.
So yeah, it is. It is. And it was one of those albums, like in my life, like looking back at the time where I was in my life, it was just really, really important record to me. So I'm going to totally nerd out. We get to meet him. We got like a little kind of before he plays, I'm going to get to go back and meet him. So I'm going to take him my CD like a 10-year-old and tell him how important this record was for my life.
Talk about everybody I know and the way we approach it is that we're first and foremost music fans. You know, everybody always wants to attach this strange, however they construe legitimacy to whatever genre you happen to play, you know, and then that gets lost. It's like, hey, we're musicians. We're fans of the guitar. We're fans of piano. We're fans of drums. You know, we're just fans of putting it together and writing songs.
Amen.
Being a part of the image, you know.
We just talked about that in our last episode about being allowed to have that fanboy moment when you meet your heroes, even though you want to be cool, but in the end, they're your heroes. And like I said, you're still just a fan.
Yeah, I've been lucky.
Oh, we all have. And it's funny too, because I have like my wife is with me a great deal of the time when, especially if we have a cool show, like getting to play with you a couple weeks ago and you know, my wife and my kids came out for that show and my dad drove out for that show as well. They were just excited about the bill, as was I, you know, getting to do things like that. And especially meeting people for the first time that you're really, really excited about. When I hold my wife's hand, like I squeeze 3 times, which means, am I being cool? Like, you know, and she'll let me know through a series of hand squeezes, like tone it down or yeah, you're being cool, you know.
So. Yeah, that's funny.
Oh, man. Awesome. Well, hey, it looks like everybody can see and hear pretty good. If you're comfortable, we're comfortable, man. I'm glad he's not the only one. I'm not the only one wearing pajama pants. Oh, yeah. But I have cowboy boots. Jason, I have cowboy boots and pajama pants on.
Nice. I've got on pajama pants, socks, t-shirt.
Yeah. We are men of leisure. I guess got this new cigar lighter, man. It looks like a crack lighter. Look at that thing, dude.
What are you smoking?
Weed.
Is it that kind of show?
Oh, yeah. It's absolutely that kind of show.
I had no idea.
There we go. That's it's a couple in. It doesn't matter what it is.
That's it. That's what we call the show. So a couple of bong rips, whatever, man.
You know.
I love the rolling intro, man. We might as well get it going. And speaking
if we're going to discuss music, you know, hey,
yeah,
let's be open about it.
We're open about our.
You're fixing to do your worst of that experience. Like you're going to have to do the hand thing. It's like, is Rodney Crowell it?
Rodney Crowell's a big one for me. That's a big one, man.
And really because of that one album, and I'm the same way. It's like when an album hits me, who I am when that, and you always have to factor that in with the greatest album, like not just how I feel about it right at this moment or whatever.
Yeah.
So he's one of yours for sure.
That is a huge, huge, huge one for me. And I've never gotten to play with him, and I've never gotten to, write or play or meet him for that matter. So
yeah.
Yeah, I'm through the series of hand squeezes tomorrow. I'm going to try not to look like too big of a dork in front of one of my songwriting, you know, heroes, which he most certainly is. But man, you fall into that category too. You're one of my songwriting heroes, and I need to get this show introed, man. And we just do little soft rolling intros. We're not too formal around here. And if you hadn't recognized his voice yet, ladies and gentlemen, it's pretty unmistakable. It is one of the most distinguishable voices in country music. One of my favorite singers, writers. Golly, man, I could throw superlatives at you all day long, man. But let's just say I'm a big, big fan. We have Josh Thompson here. We have Bobby Keith Kilgore, Seth Knows Worthy, Turning the Knobs out of Nashville, Tennessee. And our very special guest, honored and thrilled to have him on today. We have Jason Boland of Jason Boland and the Stragglers. Welcome.
Thanks for having me. Feelings mutual.
Oh,
man. Glad to be here.
I'm so excited. We have so much to talk about. We're not going to keep you too terribly long.
Well, we might.
Like 4 hours.
We're here.
Just a hair over 4 hours is all we're going to keep you
for. I have a few days off. We actually took off next weekend. Yeah, I mentioned earlier, being first and foremost a music fan, last year we saw that Brian Fallon is coming to Austin, and I've heard that he's not going to tour with Gaslight Anthem anymore, so you're only going to be able to see him solo. And my wife and I are just huge Brian Fallon fans. We're listening to some form of either Gaslight or his solo stuff. We were talking about earlier, you and I actually split in vinyl. I get the feeling there's the people that really listen to it and it's going all the time, and our household's like that. And it's a lot of Brian Fallon going on. So we found out he was coming to Austin. We were like, Valentine's Day weekend. It's Valentine's Day weekend. I called ahead and took off. And we had it all planned, and then it got canceled. So we're still trying to figure out what to do now.
Oh, no.
You can take my place and go see Casey Musgraves in Dallas.
You're not going to get that one pawned off, Bobby Keith.
Yes. I know, man. Just I'm taking trying all week.
You're going, man.
Buddy.
That's a done deal.
It sounds like you're there. No, I mean, nothing against. It's just, you
no,
know.
No. Nothing against. Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm not going to that show, but, you know, that's cool. But yeah, man, yeah. You know, I'm sorry your show got canceled, but we had this week off as well. So last time we played was actually with you guys out in Midland.
That was fun. That was fun. Your crowd, I think, got what we do better than a lot of people that we play with on your level of touring.
Our crowd is your crowd, though. I mean,
thought so. I looked out there and it felt like a really... really, really well attended straggler show.
it was.
I mean, as far as like a lot of those people, yeah, I saw a lot of the people that I normally see out there. When I can tell, you know, sometimes when we're on another big ticket and we're with a support, I can tell sometimes, you know, the fans that are just like, dudes, get these old fuckers off the stage and get me to my stuff. And I didn't catch that vibe at all. It was a hell of a lot of fun, and I really look forward to doing some more of them.
Oh, man, they were singing and dancing, and we were on the side of the stage singing and dancing as well. And we're going to do more. After we got back, I called my manager, and I was like, dude, we've got to go out with those guys again. So we're going to make that happen. But
oh, good.
Something that you did at the show, which I'm going straight to your to your last record, The Light Saw Me. See that? See, the record's not in there. It's actually on my turntable. It's been nice. It's been spinning since I stoned texted you the other night after a couple of days after we had gotten off the road. It's like, dude, I had it on my phone downloaded, but I hadn't taken it off the turntable. The first night we played two nights with you. The first night you played about half of the new record, and then you went to basically the hits. And after that show, I talked to you. I was like, dude, I thought you were going to play the whole record. I was getting really excited. And then the next night you did play the whole record, which in this business, when you can take and go and play a whole record front to back live, you know, you've got a badass record. And this record is freaking badass, dude. I love it.
We did it the next night because you said that, because we were thinking about it. And again, you know what you're there. You know what you want to do, because, I mean, at the end of the night, the only thing we want to have is the same as y'all, just a successful show. Just everybody have a good time. It's all the reason we're here. So, you know, sometimes getting out there and just doing something like that can come off as being pretentious, you know, just straight up, you know. And it's like, no, come on, man. You actually have a few songs these people know. And why would you go out and play songs that they maybe, you know, the least that they should possibly know? But it's been good. And I think the soft rollout of the album with a couple of singles, and then the way the first side of it sets anyway, we're halfway done before they even know what's going on. And then hit them with a couple of less of the sing-alongs, and they didn't seem to notice on the second night either. It was fun.
Oh no, it was fantastic, man. I was glad you guys did that. I brought this song up to you whenever we were talking A Place to Stay. I know the concept of the record, Look at Jason's Site or whatever. It's a concept record about an abduction in the 1890s, and he gets dropped off in the 1990s and everything. You know, you can read about all that stuff. I was telling you that A Place to Stay was, and I love the whole record, but that song really has grabbed me. I've probably listened to that song 50 times. My wife and I dissected it. My wife, you know, she's a big music fan, and we like to listen. We listen to a lot of your stuff and have through the years. Tell me about that song specifically, where that came from. Cause man, I am all over the place. I have like three different theories for that song.
Well, within the narrative, and that was part of the challenge of making a concept album. And I look to the people that have done really fine jobs of it, like Redheaded Stranger, Tougher Than Leather, or over like Queensryche, Operation Mindcrime. They've always kind of fascinated me. And I think bands always talk about putting together some form of a concept record or down a stylistic rabbit hole that's a little different than the bands normally. You know, there's something that really ties that album together like that. Once we got going with this, protagonist and an antagonist, and we obviously set that up with the whole alien abduction, and really what he's up against is just time, which is what we're all up against. You know, and that's just the great equalizer, and that's kind of set forth in Terrifying Nature. And then revisited with the soliloquy of, like, Here For You. And then that's the end of the first album. On the second album, he's roaming, and the roaming starts out dark, and then he sees the connectivity that exists through everything, through the light in the girl's eyes and restless spirits. So then that's why I think A Place to Stay ends up with that kind of levity and that little bit of just like maybe it's a curse, but I think it's the way humans always think of things is in that story. And in that story, there's that right off into the sunset moment after he realizes, okay, love is real. There's things that are all connected. Now within the song, we have this sympathy for this character. Hopefully we've built it by now, some reason you're connected or care even why this guy's doing that and how lost a person like that would be. And I don't think as a civilization, we look around and see what's going on with dispersed and, you know, dispossessed people all around the world. And I don't think we can ever sit around and not at this moment and say, well, we're done. We're done becoming as effective as we can with dealing with these problems around the world, you know. And I don't think the way displaced people get dealt with is always the most compassionate. We can do better. I just always think we can do better. And this guy's this displaced guy, you know, and he's like, what do I do now? And he's just looking for compassion and a place to stay. And I think when humans receive that, they surprise a lot of people.
The line specifically in regards to what you're saying right there is those in need of a second chance are those most torn apart.
Yeah.
I don't know. Just everything about that song resonates, but you know, the empath and, you know, looking for a little sympathy. Yeah, that's something that, and maybe that's why that song grabs me so much, so specifically. It seems very topical to me, even though it's part of the concept.
It was. We're trying to think. You're supposed to be, what is it, as gentle as doves and as sly as snakes and
yeah,
go about the populations and heal the sick. And
but Jason, you know, that I feel like that's a theme that you have done in the past. Like they took it away. It, you know, goes along with that theme that you're talking about. You know, I feel like you just kind of expounded on this last record on a theme that you've touched on in your music in the past before.
It's the part I think is lost about folk music a lot of times. I think when people are like, well, what's wrong with music today? It's like, because folk music lost its social sensibilities. And it's like, because they've this, I get shut up and sing too, but I also get, don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. Because then all you wound up with is like, another dirt road song. I mean, can you believe when you keep hearing these brand new industry albums, how you're just like, God dang, how do they keep doing this song over and over again? And there's nobody's like, it's crazy. And that, and then there's a Trojan horse of that thought. And it's like, oh, you just got old. I was like, no, I liked Merle Haggard, his older stuff from before I was born. So it's not that. Things go through eras and changes. And one of the last true revolutions that everybody really takes for granted is the telecommunications revolution. What we're doing right now and how fast we can get music out to people and things like that. And it, as powerful as that is of how fresh you can get something to people, it's that powerful with allowing people that, for lack of a better way to look at it, like a children's menu. A children's menu looks a certain way because they lack the palate. They haven't adapted their palate. They didn't have to go through this initiation of touching records, stacks of records at home. Like, you don't touch those until you're old enough to, you know. Now it's just like, what are you talking about? And we tell them, number one's the best. And then go, well, look, this is number one. You're like, yeah, but that's not the best. And they're like, whatever, it's number one. And they can go listen to basically Twinkle Twinkle Little Star done to a techno beat, and they'll sit there and hit that dopamine drug over and over again and never expand into like uncomfortable music and just a song for the sake of like some little other thought that didn't ever set out to be the next dance hit or the next feel good hit of the summer, just some thing that was servicing some other little muse and just in the moment. And the reason we all got into it in the first place, that just visceral experience of playing, recording, and writing tunes.
Well, and you know, you guys have always done it. You're recording, and correct me if I'm wrong, like Dark and Dirty Mile, y'all did that all analog, right?
Yeah, we did.
People that don't record for a living don't know how hard that is do what you guys do.
The way that happened is we recorded Pearl Snaps that way at Cedar Creek through a Neve tape to tape. And then we went, I won't start trying to throw people under the bus because it's not throwing them under the bus. It's a process that I didn't care for. And then we went to the early days of digital. This is like popping out of Okies. We're doing ADAT kind of thing, you know?
Yeah.
And Austin, man, you could go down there and play through the Neve, you know, tape to tape and get, yeah, they were getting great sounds out of Cedar Creek. You know how many awesome albums came out of that era. And we went and recorded that. We went and did to the digital era. And I fought always to get back to that sound I'd heard on Pearl Snaps. And I don't go back and go like, oh God, I listened to Pearl Snaps and I'm mortified. Because I'm mortified still, just like your first album. Like I can't, you know, you hear that stuff and you're just like, man, I'd give anything to, but it's just not where it was, and you accept it for what it is. But sonically, and just the way instruments sound, you know, truly sound, and how there's a, you know, there's a synergy that happens. There's a lot more going on than just instruments being played and the harmonics going on that I thought preserves, you know, were so much better preserved tape to tape than digital. And I kept hearing that, and it kept getting better and better and better. And by like Rancho Alto, we're using Clasp, which is tape dumped straight to the computer. I thought, yeah, it's real close. And then we got to Dark and Dirty Mile, and Shooter said he would do it. And that really came down to finding a producer that would just do it. And then since then, everybody's been like, okay, we'll do it again. And we did Squelch That Way, and we did Hard Times Are Relative. Now, Light Saw Me, we just went in there, and we knew it was going to get a little weird with guitars and this and that. So we just let them do it however they wanted to. And I think digital has come another leap in, you know, first, I always hated the way it made my voice sound. I always thought it sounded like grabby and compressed and weird, especially in like Truck Stop, Somewhere in the Middle, Bourbon Legend, you know, and every one of them, man, I could give y'all a show on the, you know, and you could too, on every album you do, on just the crazy weird crap that you ended up putting up with and getting an album done in spite of. But The Light Saw Me is one of the only albums I can look back on and think that had the least of all of those. It was the most fun, even in the process, and I was able to step outside and watch us make that album and enjoy it, you know, while it was happening. That's I'm sure I've had moments of that in other studio experiences. And of course, your first time in there, I think you do more than you think too, just because you're so blown away by the experience. But the rest of them after, you're thinking, oh God, I know how this happens. And I know the power contained with what we're doing. And you start to get, I started questioning too much stuff and overthinking things. And all the while trying to get back to where we had started sonically in ways. And then you get older and think, well, that's not what you're even trying to do, you know? And then there goes another album.
Absolutely. Oh, man. Wow. Jason just like said everything that goes through my mind every single time we go into the studio, like just was able to actually articulate it.
That was very well articulated.
I'm glad you think that was articulate, because it sounded rambling and incoherent on this end.
But it's really, you talk about that, but from the outside, you know, you feel like you have all those struggles. I felt that throughout your career, you have done maybe one of the best jobs out of anybody of maintaining a sound that when the song comes on, you're like, that's Jason Bolan. But this latest album was the first time I really heard a shift of like, oh man, they're trying some really crazy cool shit that I haven't ever heard them do before. And that was really refreshing to hear you say you had a great time just sitting back and listening. You know, is that something you think that style you'll carry on to more albums, or do you think that's more refined to this particular piece that you did? And
as far as just the concept,
you know, using that more funky, you know, you've got, you know, a couple instrumentals on there that are just fun as shit to listen to, and they're funky as hell, you know?
Yeah, I think we've gotten out there that far before, and we've touched on it. I do think it came together more because of the concept. This is also the first album with a new drummer, Jake Lynn. This is the first time he's got a chance to record a full album with us.
And he's great, man. He was fun to watch.
Yeah, he's a super talented dude, super talented singer, did all
the harmonies on the album. Yeah, he's a great singer. Yeah, that's what I noticed too, is how his backing vocals were fantastic.
Yeah, he's a hoss. And Grant and him have really locked up a thing. We had a bass amp in the room. This was the first time I think that I've ever even seen that, as far as like an actual cabinet going in the cut room. Because you know that has to ambiently hit some stuff. But
absolutely,
I'm always for that, especially guys that know their drum. And that's Dave Sprague. I'm going to mess something up, but Dave Bianco built this studio in North Hollywood. All kinds of cool people recorded there. He passed away ownership shifted, and I believe at least part of ownership to the main engineer, Dave Sprague. So it happens to still be called Dave's Room. And man, he's got the drums dialed. I always tell people, you know, if you even look back on a lot of the real garagey bands, man, a lot of them still had really good drummers, because you just can't have good anything if it's not in time. A lot, and everybody will go, well, what about? Okay, yeah, exceptions to everything. But for the most part, you get in the studio, squeak on the drum pedal, we're stopped. There we go. And we can't even get the downbeat of song one done because of a squeak, you know?
Yeah.
So it turns out that so much always goes back to that. And when you can find a guy that has their drum sounds dialed, and Brad did this too, my original drummer, like if you had a room that you get there and they're like, man, I know you want to set your kit up, but trust me, that if you can play that kit, you can move it however you want, but we got it there. Lots of times studios have that, and they had a couple of different kits, but they really more had the room dialed where they could just set any kit as long as they set it in about that spot. And it kind of had like a little TV studio feel, more a little bit wider of a cut room and not so high as some of the new ones. But man, it was one of those little industrial park, and then you step into this quiet little hobbit hole of a studio, and it was just a racetrack with a kitchen in the back and a coffee machine that we put some miles on and we had dispensaries in walking distance. Oh man, it was just, it's the way it ought to be done. It was so fun.
Did you guys do that all in one session, or did y'all break that up any?
One. We did it. Nice. It was just under 2 weeks, I think.
Okay.
And man, we had our shit together too. And it's funny. I remember looking over at Shooter at one point, and he was saying something about it. He's like, man, I'm glad y'all really had it rehearsed and everything. And I said, I do too, because I don't know how. Some people are like, yeah, man, we just, you know, we had some riffs in there and we went in there and wrote and all this. I'm thinking, how long did you stay in there? Because we got in there and slammed out like the rhythm tracks in 2 days, you know, a night and a day and then a morning or something with the recuts. Yeah. Like, we thought that was a little slow. And then, and just slammed them. I sang it in two and something, and just, I don't know. And we were very organized, and we still ran right up to the end of our allotted time. And it blows my mind.
Again, Shooter Jennings produced this record. Was his first one Dark and Dirty Mile with you? Is that the first one y'all worked on together?
Yeah. Yeah.
You're talking about like how much fun you had, how relaxed it was in the whole scenario. Do you think that age and like Josh was saying, you're consistent. We know it's Jason Boland Stragglers. You know, age, kind of chilling back and saying, this is what we do on the same, at the same time, we're used to working with Shooter. He knows how we operate. You know, was that all just come together for a perfect storm?
Yeah. And I think the X factor of that perfect storm of just like what you said, you know, his Black Ribbons album, it's like, I'm not going to weird you out with any kind of concept album. His experience since Dark and Dirty, which is funny because Dark and Dirty, like, you know, it had its challenge, which was tape to tape in those days. It is mixing the album and having to listen from far and having to have them pull mixes again. The fact that it was a concept album provided an extra amount of focus, just that extra 20%. And that allowed us to rehearse it and really have a fleshed out idea of what we were going to do when we got in there, right down to the instrumentals. And I think I had really, on the way out there, I finished like a last two or three lines of lyrics. It was, there might've been one, you know, when you do the re-sing a scratch line that you don't have yet.
Oh yeah.
When you're in there cutting it, you're like,
sure.
Sorry, y'all have to listen to this other verse again, but I just don't, I'm not where I'm at, you know? And, yeah, I know. And it's so weird too, 'cause you think it's the biggest deal. And the bass player's over there, he's like, I really don't care. Like, don't care.
they're sitting there going, I wasn't listening to the words anyway. Like,
yeah,
I'm just,
yeah, I'm saying, I was like, saying I don't care. No, and I'm not throwing my guys, we have a good repertoire, and I'm as blown away by the fact that we're still doing this. And that's enough of the ego thing I need. And I'm fortunate that I do think all my guys enjoy what we do. And that all goes back to ultimately our message is, and I take this from Bob Childers, and we take things from our mentors and the people that really teach us the things that we want to do when we take this seriously. And he said, all my songs are love songs. He said, at the end of the day, that's the light at the end of every tunnel. And if you're going to stand up there in front of people and sing about stuff, like, you know, tell them things and have them sing back to you. And that doesn't mean you can't sing about darkness and you can't sing about hard times and hedonism and things like that. But at the end of the day, and the light at the end of the tunnel is always loved. And he said all of his songs are love songs. So that's really our mission statement as a band. Whether you think you're hearing a song about drinking or you're thinking of hearing a song about trying to find out where we all fit in on a spiritual journey, we still want it to be from a place of peace, love, and just awe of existence that we all feel. And that's part of the reason I think musicians and poets and people like us, no matter what part of the culture, you know, and its rougher and less cultured sides we represent, you know, still come from a valid place and a valid point. And we've always tried to do that. And when we were saying earlier about the sound, it's such an overstated thing to say, trying to keep it real, you know, but that's all we've ever tried to do, is just try to keep real to what we are and why somebody would listen to us. Because I know we've never been the greatest singers or the greatest songwriters or the greatest players. You know, that's not what we've ever been about. It's just back to being first and foremost music fans, just wanting to be a part of the wave of culture that happened while you were here in this weird little spot that we saw that switched over from the digital world, you know, from the old analog ways. And that goes with a lot of things back down to this and where we fit into that as rural or Americana or country music or whatever. That's really just been our surge. It's a hidden within what we are.
I think authenticity has as much to do with it, because you can record digital, you can record analog, you can set up the old, you know, jam box like we did when we were kids and hit the record button onto a cassette tape. Underground tape trading stuff's like,
yeah,
if it's there, it's there, you know. And gosh, man, I can barely play the guitar. I can play it well enough to, you know, show the guys in the band who know actually how to play their instruments.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's more of a feeling, you know. I mean, like, look at how cool Keith Richards is, man. Like, is he the best guitar player in the world? No. Is he one of the most badass? Yeah. You know, I mean, it's the authenticity's there.
Yeah.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, that's what we want.
You mentioned Bob Childers a while ago. Tell us about Bob Childers. Tell the people that don't know Bob Childers, you know, and Bob's been gone for a while now, but, you know, what was your experience with him?
Well, Bob had settled back. He didn't grow up in Stillwater. I believe he was born in West Virginia, and he had bounced around from Ponca City area, Oklahoma, and Stillwater, and had lived in L.A., spent time in Nashville, just classic, you know, songwriter, traveling kind of guy. And he was living at a place called The Farm in Stillwater, where it was just outside of town enough that nobody messed with anybody out there. And one of the guys had the lease on it. And he was, I think, the only one still actively going to school. And he was a recreation major. And then there was still a couple of the, like, Reddit living out there. I think Monica Taylor was living out there at the time. And Childers had a camper back behind this little makeshift stage that they referred to as the Gypsy Cafe. And it was just a community of singers and songwriters that had been doing it a long time and doing it for all the, make all the wrong decisions for all the right reasons. So they may not look as successful to a lot of people, but they knew what they were doing, and they were all interesting, and they all had stories to tell, and they were all good songwriters, and they all wound up around these campfires certain nights. And from playing out at a couple of the clubs with Cody Canada and Mike McClure and the other young guys that were just hanging around that club scene and playing, got invited out to some parties out there. And when you would get there, it was so just focused on people sitting around playing music. If there was a campfire going, there was a guitar going around. And if you wanted to go, you know, be somewhere, you could go get away from the fire. But there was always a singer-songwriter campfire going, and there was always a guitar going around. And I remember walking up the first time, and you know how it is. Sometimes you want to have campfires where we're from. You know, you just need to have your wits about you. And the guy I was talking about that owned actually had the lease rented on this house. And he was walking up, and I see somebody coming up back from the fire, and I just hear, "Welcome." You know, and just this very welcoming tone. You sit down, and there's Bob. I don't remember if he was the first one playing a song, but immediately he got around to him. And he just had a way about his songwriting, again, where I don't think his songs were ever just intended for mass consumption. That doesn't mean they can't be super successful songs, but his songs, you get the sense they were always servicing some muse. And that's cool if that taps into everybody at any given moment, which a lot of that just has to do how it's produced a lot in a song. And producers can do crazy things with a song. So to the point that sometimes the producer is the co-writer of that song. But Bob just had a way about him as a human like that, where you come from a place where there wasn't American Idol or anything. It was, you're going to do what? You're going to go play in smoky ass bars and play. And music in general would have got looked upon weird unless you were like, no, I'm going to Berkeley, I'm going to Juilliard or something. But always just like, I'm going to go play music for a living. That's going to raise eyebrows. I don't think it does as much anymore. And that's great. That means people are out there playing. I think everybody ought to play music. And if it works out for you, good. But that doesn't mean what you did was good or not. And Bob had some success and had some people cut his songs. But it was always that there was a weird wall that seemed to be tough for some of the kind of non-traditional hippie folky, more in the line of like Woody Guthrie songwriter. They just didn't get the cuts like a lot of other people did. And another thing that I was just talking to Mandy, my wife, about was that I went and saw Scott Hendricks give a speech at Oklahoma State with Bob Childers. And Scott was just talking about Nashville and the whole community and the way this business works. And he said, must be present to win. He says it's one of those competitions. And like, if you want to be a singer-songwriter or if you want to be plugged into the Nashville songwriter scene, you ain't going to do it from anywhere else. You got to be there and you got to go do it. Bob was kind of like telling me, so if you want to do this, because at the time I was just playing out around, you know, and McClure was helping me publish my stuff, but we weren't really off and running as a band. I was really more looking at seeing about getting these songs that I was now getting published by a guy that had his own publishing company. What do I do now? And it was moved to Nashville. I thought, I don't know. And about that time I was meeting Roger, and he was saying, I know a guy that'll play bass. I said, I know a guy that'll play drums. And we booked our first few shows, and through Mike, we met Lloyd Maines, and he said he would produce us. We did that first one and been playing every place that'll let us in the door ever since, pretty much.
Yeah. Yeah. You guys have, man. It was funny. I was, when I came home with those two records that you had signed for me, and it had the 20th anniversary Pearl Snaps vinyl remastered, and sitting there going, man, like, I remember when that was a new record, you know, and when I was, yeah. when I was a much younger Jason Boland fan, and a much younger Jason Boland as well, you know.
Did you get it at Hastings?
At Hastings.
Yeah.
Oh, I had one.
Hastings would consign them, and it was awesome. So at one point, I looked up all the major reporter radio stations that I could find on the Texas chart, and I sent them all a copy of Pearl Snaps. I did all my follow-up calls and everything, just like I was a single pusher. And then Roger said, well, Hastings will consign any of these albums if you'll go out on the road on a week off that we had a weekend off for some reason or another. He's like, I'll plot out this journey. And me and my road manager, Red, we jumped in and we went down through McKinney and College Station and then down to like Lake Jackson. Because if you notice, Hastings stayed out of all the big, big cities.
Mm-hmm. They did.
They were kind of always peripheral. Mm-hmm. And so we went all through this weird tour of consigning albums at Hastings.
We did. We had two or three Hastings that we consigned albums on. Mostly in East Texas back in the day.
They were great.
That shows how old we are.
Yeah, but it was great. It was a great way because they always had that local or Texas section, or they always had some kind of local section.
Mm-hmm.
And man, I was sad to see Hastings go. Those were happy places for me, man. I would go get a coffee and go get lost in there for an hour or two.
Nostalgia rising, man. Vinyl, you're a vinyl guy. And I was telling you last time we spoke, we don't even have a TV in our living room. We have a record player.
Yeah.
And we have TVs in our house. We're not like, whatever. We're not those people. Those people, there's nothing wrong with those people. Whatever.
You got to be so
at home, Cody. Come on. You got to be so fucking careful these days. Everybody getting their fucking feelings hurt.
Those
shit.
Other assholes. Them other assholes.
Them other assholes.
No, not those. No, not those.
The other ones, you know. But don't you miss going to a record store? And even when it became CDs, but just the going through, you see the motion. I'm like digging through.
Yeah, yeah.
Vinyls or those big plastic things they used to keep the CDs in, like at Hastings, you know, and I miss those days, man.
Yeah, I do. When it was just more normal, you still find them. You just got to go to your local record shop. You know, Sundance is back open in San Marcos. Waterloo's always great. You know, you just got to go find them. But man, like, even in Austin, you know, Cheapo went out. Half Price Books is really one of the best places to go. Just thumb through what you never know you're going to find. Yeah, just that being the norm of like a disc jockey in the mall or wherever you go find it. That small amount of disposable income that you had to actually go to, because, you know, let's face it, mom and dad ain't buying Iron Maiden. If I want Iron Maiden, I got to get it myself. If you want to listen to Power Slave, it's going to cost you $8.99 of your own.
I'm a huge Iron Maiden fan too, but I remember going to Blockbuster Music when I was 15, and because mom and dad weren't buying the new AC/DC record.
Yeah.
And when that record came out, it was the Ballbreaker record. I was 15 years old, and we all went as a family. We went to Blockbuster Music, and I got this record. It was me and my mom, my dad, and my little sister at the time, who my little sister would have been like 8 or 9. And we get back in the truck to go home, you know, and I had bought the AC/DC record with my own money because at 15, I did have a job. Dad's like, what'd you get, son? And dad was a hard guy, hard man growing up. Like he was a
stern.
Yeah. So anyway, he goes, what'd you get? I was like, nothing.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just an AC/DC record. Oh, well, why don't you let us hear it? And I was like, we don't need to do that. You know, it's probably not good. You know, they're old now. Yeah. Opens it up. He's like, well, let me see those lyrics. And he puts in this song, and fast forward, he says, oh, let's see what this song is about. It's called Honey Roll. The first lyrics of the song are like, honey roll over, lettuce on top, or something like that.
And, yeah, just let the innuendos begin.
You know, and my mom was driving. He looks over at my mom and goes, turn around, we're taking it back.
Oh my gosh. Really?
And I'm like, oh. And it was just one of those days. He was just in a mood, I guess, you know?
Oh yeah. So it took it all the way.
Yeah, all the way back. to Blockbuster Music. So I think like the following week or whatever, my mom drove me back up there and I went and bought the same record again, you know, but you know, they damn sure weren't buying AC/DC and Iron Maiden.
Yeah. And well, now, and you don't, when they try to claim like, I taught him everything he knows, you're like, no, I had to go find some of that on my own.
Yeah.
I was always wanting to throw music in people's faces, though. I was always like, oh, listen to this, you know, and if it was more extreme, I wanted people to hear it. I was probably annoying.
Yeah, but that, you know, that's how this whole conversation started. As a fan, you know, we all know, we're all in the music business. We all know what music did to us, that feeling that you got whenever you heard a certain song. And, you know, you were probably the same. I would sit by my radio, you know, when I was a kid with a blank tape, and whenever whatever song, the new Scorpions tune came on or whatever, you know, it was like, oh, and then you, years later, you find all these old cassette recordings of the first 5 seconds of a song missing, you know, it's like your own like mixed tape. And we would make all those and then make our friends listen to them.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And
you have to.
Yeah. You've got to hear this one, or you'd call in and request and hopefully they would say your name before it. Ours was the Cat 107.7 FM. And late night, you might get a weird request in there. Oh, no. Yeah, the Cat. No, 100.5 was the Cat. Oh, somebody just rolled over. Cody Canada just like, Cody Canada was sitting somewhere and he just went, somebody just give the wrong numbers to the Cat 105. Yeah. Oh, man. Tell me who you're listening to out there, and they would say your town's name on a request. If you could get that on your mixtape, boom. You just got AC/DC dedicated to you in your town.
That's a big deal, man.
Oh, back in those days. I mean, we say back in those days. I mean, where else would you – people just have access to broadcast whatever they want at any given moment. Now, you know, and that's a great thing, but it does take that special mind-blowingness of when things used to happen, or when you didn't really know what a band looked like. You know, you'd see them,
absolutely,
some bad pictures of them and stuff, and you'd show up and you're like, that's Chopper.
Yeah, it was a more of a mystery, you know. You didn't,
yeah,
it wasn't like it is today. You know, bands didn't have Instagrams and Facebooks and all the things that we have now. And I mean, like you were talking about ADATs a while ago, the first record I ever made was on an ADAT, you know, and there's people out there going, what the hell is an ADAT?
You know? It'll never go back. People will touch on the other as nostalgia. And I didn't do it as nostalgia. I did it because that's how I wanted us to capture ourselves.
Yeah.
And, you know, the way we do them, and a lot of bands do it this way too. We have to call it out because nobody gets or cares that they can be completely chopped together and you can completely listen to a robot album and not know it. But like to go in there, capture drums, bass, a rhythm guitar. God forbid you get a good scratch vocal and something like, we're keeping that, you know, and that's happened before. Mm-hmm. But get in there and catch as much of the live feel as you can at once. Even if you do sing over those scratches, still what you capture and listen back to. And then when you're ready to go in there and cut vocals, it puts you back there and you remember what the magic you captured. We always do the go in just rehearsed enough that something can still happen, but not enough, you know, not green enough that you'll just get in there and waste time and not have a concept of what's going on. And that's usually how we hit it and try to capture as much of the feel we can as once and keep it true and honest and not really hide who we are. I almost think the better a band is, it's like, okay, go ahead and use all the tools then. You're freaking awesome. You're amazing. And we know you can do it. With us, it's like, nah, man, we always got to prove it. We always got to prove why we deserve to be here and exist in this. And I don't know if that's just my own goofball brain or what I do to keep myself to have a reason to keep saying things. I got down to this album. I thought, what do I even want to say? And thankfully it happened before COVID. And now there's a few other things to think, okay, we can still talk about some of this and some of this that maybe I thought was beaten to the ground. And maybe some of that will come up later, but that this thing was all fleshed out before it. But it was also a way to talk about the things that you talked about in a lot of albums, like, you know, your love songs and songs of longing and missing and traveling on the road, and how to do that with something other than just the same old way to approach it and keep our souls interested. So I don't know. We'll just keep going from here and see what's next. And I've got a few things that are starting to, once I get completely done with an album and it's out, that tends to be when I start coming up with other stuff to write and think about. Yeah. And it's weird, before it's completely done, like we're still in proofreading lyrics, I just don't come up with anything new. I don't do it. And the second we step away from it, I'll be playing guitar and just start thinking of something else. But until it's completely gone and completely out of my hands, which, you know, just happened in December, and I've already starting to feel the itch to at least be creative again, whatever that is, wherever that starts from.
I love to hear that you still feel like you have something to prove, even though I feel like, I think that you were one of the top guy for this genre for a very, very long time, but yet you still have that I've got to prove it to everybody else mentality.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just, I don't ever feel like, I think it's because I always saw this as just like singer, songwriter, folk music and all that. And when you're in a world of producing your own music and running your own touring and just doing that all together, and y'all can attest to this too, you do feel a pressure of, it's a big freaking boat. It's a big thing to keep together, and you keep the fuel in the thing by coming up with whatever we put out there. And it's not an orange and it's not a truck. It's this very subjective thing. That's why I think if you truly ask any musician that's still doing it, they're also, I would like to think they're still fascinated. I also think some of the really good entertainers, and it's just the way God made them, are probably deep down narcissistic enough. They're like, no, this is exactly what's supposed to happen. And that's cool because it keeps them from getting nervous when they're singing the Star Spangled Banner at the Super Bowl, you know? And I don't, let the people that are good at doing that type of stuff, I never wanted to do that or needed the fame ego scratched. At the same time, you're taking music that's personal and really close to you, and you're putting it out there. You didn't put it out there for nobody to like it. So that's why, that brings us back to why we approach it the way we can approach it like that and put it out there and not feel completely, you know, self-absorbed about doing it, is put out good things for people to know and listen to and travel through in their life and have in their heads, rather than, you know, maybe something that may not feed their soul as much. And then it also have music that's secular that does that. Everybody would say, well, just go listen to religious music. And it's like, well, there's that too. But I think Americana and folk music always tries to do a good job of, and always did, and I think it's still, the underground still does too. We're always comparing where everything lands with mass media, but I think the underground still does a good job of talking about some things every once in a while and bringing up subjects that might make people feel like they were the only ones more, you know, dealing with this, and it comes back to them, you know. But I think Americana and folk country have really left their listeners high and dry in that aspect a long time. And you see it by just nobody that I know listens to a lot of the top 40 country.
Oh, yeah, I don't.
And when I say top 40, you guys are getting like that mainstream success, you know, and Cody Johnson and I watch iTunes close, and you are up there all the time, multiple albums. And so I think when it comes down to what people are really going out there and getting, man, you hit up in there. And that's good, because when somebody asked me this the other day, they're like, don't you think the tide is kind of turning? I mean, look at the success. And they brought up, you know, like you and Co and Cody Johnson, and even like, you know, everybody brings up Sturgill and Tyler and everything that's just off of the dance music. I mean, we can call it out for what it really, some of it has gotten to be. and it's fine, and that's cool, and it can have its place in the world. I'm not dogging it. It's just like, for my taste, that's why I'm down there spinning what I am, like the new Sunvolt album or an old Nina Simone album. If it's good, I listen to it, you know, and there used to be more good country. And I think in like somebody, it was an interview and they brought it up and they said, don't you think it kind of has? It's like, step back and really look at it and turn around and look at, I thought, you know what? When I look at the iTunes charts, I do see a lot of people I know on it. When the people are given a choice to speak, I mean, I'd like to see your Spotify. Send me over your artist link. Let me log into your Spotify. I'm dying to see it. Because, you know, I watched mine. This is one of the first times we ever, like, went after Spotify, which is, of course, the time now they're getting lit up, whatever.
God, yeah, they're getting basted.
Of course, the first time we even tried to push to it, you know, they're like, your Pandora numbers are good, you know, and all these streaming platforms that we've tried to keep a presence on, but, you know, not really. So Spotify on this one, we're like, we're going to pump Spotify releases on this one. So I watched it close, and I'm always thinking, I wonder what your monthly listeners are. You can't help but wonder.
I don't even know. I haven't heard in some months. I try not to pay too much attention to that stuff because I get worked up. It's kind of like when I read reviews, yeah, you know, or like comments on a Facebook post. Like, I have to stay away from reviews, comments on a post, and like what my monthly numbers are for Spotify, because I internalize everything, yeah, and I get fixated on stuff, the minutiae. It's the stuff, it's the little shit that gets me really jacked up in the head.
Yeah.
And so I try not to look at that stuff, because right now, like, if you looked at my Spotify numbers, it's like, oh man, you know, whatever got spun, you know, 500 times, 500,000 times, or 2 million times in the last month. Like, I don't know. I couldn't tell you.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's the thing. We don't have anything to compare it to, but that's what I'm always looking at. And I'll ask my people, is this good? Like, oh yeah. And,
oh yeah. And yeah, say, this is great. Yeah.
It's great. And they don't, and they stop themselves short of saying for you. Yeah. That's going to sound wrong.
I mean, like,
it's better than your old shit numbers, but I mean, are you talking like Drake good? Are you talking like Ed Sheeran good? No, not good. Then what did you want to hear? No, but they're
Cody,
they're
yours
cool.
yours on Google says 2.2.
2.2. I don't even know what that means.
Like, 2.2 million monthly listeners.
That's what I have. Okay. Well,
yeah, that's good.
I didn't learn about Drake until about, 5-6 months ago, because my management sent me a link. We had just dropped our record, and one of the first singles went to some national playlist on Spotify or something. Say, congratulations, you're on a national most spun list with Drake. I was like, that's cool. Who's Drake? You know, and my manager goes, are you kidding, man? And I was like, no, dude, I don't, who's Drake? And he goes, it's like one of the most successful guys on the planet right now. I was like, oh, so that must be pretty cool then, right? He was like, oh, yeah.
The this meme guy.
Yeah.
Oh, the this meme guy. Yeah.
I was like, I don't know. Is this good? So anyway, yeah, evidently that was good.
I just know him from that good Nickelodeon show.
I don't know.
Yeah, man. Hey, a lot of those kids shows, man, have launched some super successful artists. And that's, yeah, that's back to what I think when people think we got sour grapes or bad taste about anything like that, it's like, man, those folks that are in any form of entertainment that perform at a level that they perform, that is hard work, and they're all amazingly talented at what they do. And I guess we've lost being able to be critical of anything. Like, yeah, but it's just not my thing, you know? And then they can always just say, well, yeah, you're old. And it's like, cool, whatever. But I go back to listen to music that's older than me, you know? So,
yeah. We could do this for hours. I love having conversations with you. The few that we've had, you always have a profound look at what's going on, and we could do this for hours, but yeah. I don't want to keep you, because I'd love to have you on again at another time, and we would have more things to talk about. I do want to tell a funny story before we let you go. I mean, and when I'm wrapping it up, that means like you're going to be on at least like another more 15 minutes or so, you know, because it takes me forever to wrap things up. So if you're good for another minute or two, we'll do a couple things at the end with Josh and Bobby Keith. I have to tell you this story. Josh, do you remember about maybe 7-8 years ago, Jason and the Stragglers were playing at the Cajun Cowboy in Omaha, Texas?
Oh my God, dude. Now I would have never thought that until you said that, but I do remember it now.
My dad is a huge, huge fan of yours and drove out 8 hours to see, you know, our show when we did the Midland thing with you guys.
Yeah.
And drove home the next day.
Nice. And
cause he was so excited that we were billed together. So like 6-8 years ago ish, probably closer to 8 years ago ish. There's a little bar in my mom and dad's town in East Texas where they live called the Cajun Cowboy. It's in Omaha. Shout out to Omaha. And, it was, you were playing on a Friday night and we were booked there on a Saturday night. And my dad called me and he said, hey, he said, y'all just come down a day early and come see the Jason Boland show with us. And I was like, we can't, Dad. Like, we were going to play some $500 bar that night and make $100 a piece. Cause that's how the wheels went round and round at that time. And I said, we can't afford to take a Friday off. And he said, I'll pay your band. He goes, he said, I'll pay y'all to come down and watch the show with us. I was like, well, then hell yeah.
Nice.
So we go down a day early. We get to see your show with Dad. And then I'd already, you know, met Roger at that time. Roger had done some steel work on one of our records. We were sitting there on your bus and there was a pipe going around. Somebody had like this weed that looked like one of those dried out cat turds. It was almost white. You know what I'm talking about? It's just one of those. Sometimes you get it and you're like, damn, dude.
Mm.
It's just that color.
Yeah.
It was really good. But my dad looks at it and looked really unfamiliar to him. And Dad and Roger were sitting like on one end of the couch, just BSing, you know, and that pipe came by me and I took a chunk of that white bud and put it down in the pipe and take a rip. My dad looks over at Roger and he goes, what is that they're smoking? Roger, without missing a beat, goes, heroin.
Yeah. And, that's right.
And,
yeah.
And my dad was like, what? He says, oh yeah, yeah, they're smoking heroin. So my dad's sitting there like getting mad at me, like legitimately getting pissed off. He's sitting there
but
starting.
Also, you know, he wouldn't like completely freak in that moment either.
Yeah, he wasn't freaking, but he was about to. And like Roger could tell that it, because I was sitting there stoned. I was oblivious. I didn't know. You know, I was just sitting there talking with everybody and, you know, hi. And finally Roger could like tell my dad was like getting red. And Roger's like, no, man, I'm just joking. I'm just joking. They're smoking weed. My dad's like, oh, I've never seen any weed like that. But anyway, Roger got me that close to getting my ass whipped after we got off that bus that night.
By your own dad.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good stuff, man. We definitely, especially back in those days, man, it was a serious locker room around there. And they're worse. Those locker rooms are worse when you're in your 20s, 30s.
Yeah, it's slowing down. We can tell we
just some you've heard all the jokes. It's now it's just like foregone conclusions of the jokes.
Yeah.
Now you just everybody's there actually nice to everybody.
Yeah.
Used to what we allowed each other to do was, I know how you feel waking up on the road and you really just want to shower and go to the bathroom. So if you need somebody to just like say some outlandish shit to, come on.
Yeah,
I got my coffee. Just fire away. It doesn't even have to make sense.
Yeah.
I used to have a couple guys in the road. We would just wake up and just call each other names. People heard it. They would probably think we were really not caring for each other, but you just a bunch of dudes. And I know a lot of buses are like this too. You'd be amazed how good everybody gets along over years and years. Have there been fights? Absolutely. But not every day. You know, where you think of like all those dudes in there, you know, it shows you music is just a wonderful common goal to have,
yep.
You know, and the road's a good enemy for everybody to have.
Be surprised at how well everybody does get along. You know, at this point, we're all so used to each other and have been for years that it's like, man, I don't want to do it with anybody else at this point. You know, it's like everybody, it's kind of like that old comfortable pair of tennis shoes or blue jeans or whatever. It's just, it works, you know, like I can wake up in the morning and walk out, you know, usually Josh has already got the pot of coffee made. Nice. And there may be a morning exchange, and there may not be. We may not say anything until I see everybody up for sound check or whatever. Those buses get real small real quick, but you have to really, like you said too, if people would heard our conversations, read a dialogue of our conversations, you might think most days we hated each other. It's how many times a day does you know, Josh look at Keith and say, fuck off, man?
Yeah. Every day.
Every day, at least two or three times. Like,
yeah. You know, but that's what we do.
What we do.
Or you sound really stupid right now.
Yeah. He sounds stupid.
Yeah.
Kenny, our road manager and merch guy, he got a good D's nuts as he left the bus the other day with a Wendy's.
I love it. Well, it's cool, man. Well, hey, while we've got you, like I said, it takes a minute to wrap up. We're going to throw this last segment at you. It's called Why Do I Know This? And this is when Josh and Bobby Keith come at you real hard with those hard hitting questions that everybody wants to know the answers to.
Hey, wait, okay. can I show y'all something real quick? I found this earlier. This is 2008. Look at this.
Nice. Hey, I just saw that t-shirt. When I went to grab this t-shirt, I just saw that t-shirt in my drawer.
I thought y'all get a good laugh at that.
That's you look good... like you were like 12.
Dude, I was young, man. I don't even think I was 21.
Oh, my word. Wow. All right. Why do I know this time?
This is Jason, I hope you're excited. This is a multi-award winning segment that we do here on A Couple In. So you can answer as quick, you know, short answer, long answer, whatever you want to do. So, I have a new question, Bobby Keith. So I'm going to start with, how old is your wallet, Jason?
10 years old in June.
Nice.
Do you want to know why? You're like,
how do you know that?
Because I got it on my wedding trip.
But it's going to be one of those, like, you'll keep that for a while, yeah?
Yeah, I stuff like that I tend to keep until it completely gives out. The wallet before that was another 15 years or so.
Me too. All right, cool. Are you playing Wordle?
No.
Okay. What's your least favorite ice cream?
I play PUBG. Least favorite ice cream, anything with mint in it. If I need to brush my teeth, I'll brush my teeth.
Man, that is the best answer that has been given so far. That's an A+. All right. And last question. Do you believe? Oh, yeah, man, this one may go forever. Do you believe in ghosts?
Not in the traditional, like, psychological entity thing, because first of all, scientifically, it looks like that wouldn't. And then religious people would be like, what about ghosts? And you're like, are you telling me like God can't take this? The soul is so tormented, it must still walk this hallway in physical earth when really we're on this rock tumbling through the cosmos. It's just like, now, like how a boat leaves ripples in water, do humans' yes. energies and souls maybe leave ripples in like space-time and stuff, and like we might see something or tune into something that we don't interpret right? I think maybe something more like that than just this disembodied, oh, that was Jason, but because he tripped and fell down the stairs, he can't leave this place, and he walks it every night. That's a little hokey for me, so I'll say yeah, nah on that one.
Man, golly, I love that question. Okay, Bobby Keith, you're next. See, award-winning.
Favorite video game, past or present?
Present, PUBG. Mobile. PUBG Mobile. It's the people's game.
What about a favorite 2 a.m. meal?
Cold pizza, probably. Yeah.
Morning person or a night owl?
A night owl.
And last, do you have a favorite memory with Cody?
We don't have a lot of memories.
That was the only thing. Yeah, I didn't know if like y'all hung out in Midland.
But I mean, honestly, I think just my good memories, a lot of times, first of all, you know, every time we get to see each other at the shows, but honestly, knowing that somebody out there, because I've always been aware, and like I said, we met years ago and we would meet here and there in times and times, and I'm not glad we're getting to know each other better and play songs now. But in this, you feel there's this commiseration, like at least I'm out there and I know what you're going through, and I see the level that Cody's doing it and keeps it going, and it's inspiring to me. And I think overall, just the way y'all have, the Cody approaches his business and his whole organization approaches their business is inspiring. And I love seeing somebody having success on their terms. Of course, that's just fuel for the fire for me too. So looking forward to having a few more times that we get to hang out and shoot the shit. Now it's probably this time.
Well, you know what? Keith, I'm glad you asked that question though, because that reminded me of something, a favorite memory I have of Jason. We opened for you guys in God, people in Illinois get so mad at me. I can't remember if it's Macomb or Macomb, Illinois. It's one of those two.
Yeah.
I'm sure that
down there by Mechanicsburg, that one.
Somebody's going to let me know. Yeah. We were opening for you guys in that town in Illinois years ago. At the time, we were in a motorhome. We were in an RV. Her name was Dirty Dolly. And we were parked behind your bus. After the show, like, we really didn't talk much because you went out and said hi to people and talked, you know, stuff. And we had gotten done, and I had done the same thing and just had watched your show. And we went and got back on the RV, and we were going to head on down the road. And there was a knock at the door. And at this time, like, I really didn't know you. And I don't even know if we'd, like, met maybe once before, something like this, but I was like a real big fan. And there's a knock on the door, and Josh opens the door, and like I'm sitting on the couch, and like there's this little exchange of words. Oh, okay, man. Yeah, yeah, cool. Hey, man, y'all be careful, you know, y'all. And he shuts the door, and I was like, who's that? He was like, oh, it's Jason. He was just came to say hi and you know, bye and all that kind of stuff. And I was like, what the fuck, dude? I didn't even get to talk to him. You know, and so like I bust out of the door and I'm trucking it down the side. I'm like, Jason, hey, man, it's me, Cody. Hey, man. Hey, just, you know, thanks for letting us open for you and all this kind of stuff. And you were so nice to just drop by and say hi and thank you for being there and all that kind of stuff. So that was just kind of a funny thing that I can remember there.
I always like meeting everybody because I'm still fascinated again by what it takes to really just step out there on that limb and do it. Cause it's a lot of limbs to step out on when you produce music, write music, play it live for people, try to get it down the road. Man, I'm in awe of all of us. And it's always good to meet somebody else that's got the dream. And I just like look forward to seeing where everybody takes it. Cause it's just going to get faster and stranger with media, and I think that's really going to make this underground of reality still walking in a place like the Rock and Rodeo in Midland or somewhere. You can't smell that place digitally, or you know just what I mean, of just really, and a band still hitting the stage and an amp still hitting you and dancing. That'll never be fully simulated, or maybe it will be, but I figure we'll be gone by the time that's actually full-on simulated, and it just keeps us going.
Yeah, man. Where things are going. With, you know, Oculus concerts and, you know, all that kind of stuff. That's something, you know, and I can't say this or that, but like you said, there's nothing that you get that is the feeling that you get whenever you feel that kick drum thump you in the chest when you're sitting there on the floor.
Yeah.
You know, the band's about to kick up, you know, and you hear that snare go, yeah. And then you hear a thump, thump, and you can feel that shit.
Mm-mm. Yeah.
Eddie
Shaver checking the mess of boogie.
Yeah. That's the, oh, I still get it. You know, I still like, you know, watching you guys play, I'm sitting there going, damn, man, I want to do that, you know. And guess what? We all get to, and we get to, and we still do. And here's to more shows with you on down the line, man. Just thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to be a part of this, and your insights on things. And we'd love to have you back again, man. Anything you need to plug, want to plug, websites, Facebooks, Instagrams, places to go to purchase your music.
All of those. I don't know what we're not on. We're on Google, Instagram, Amazon, Google Music. Is it still Google Music, or now it's like YouTube Music? And then
hell, I don't know.
Apple. You can get our music anywhere you try to get music, and you can find us at thestragglers.com. And our tour's usually up on Instagram or thestragglers.com somewhere, and it's usually pretty well updated nowadays.
Heck yeah,
we'll
be out
there. We're gonna light saw me it for the rest of the spring and probably into the summer, into the hard ticket stuff. See how that goes, and then start looking about getting back into the studio. I think we're due for a third live album too. We didn't repeat anything from live one to High in the Rockies, so I'd like to do a third live album with no repeats on it either, and kind of just capture a good long three album era of whatever it was we did out here. I don't know. What did it look like to you?
Oh, man. I love it, dude. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Yeah, man. And, man, anytime, we'd love to have you back on. For Josh Thompson, Bobby Keith Kilgore, Seth Knows Noseworthy, Turning the Knobs. You've been listening to A Couple In with Cody Jinks. Today, our guest has been Jason Bolin. Jason Bolin and the Stragglers. Till we're able to do it again, brother. All the best. Peace, love, all the good stuff, man.
Thank you. We'll see you later.